So how can we handle conflict better at work and learn to speak up without anxiety? Hello, I'm Chester Elton, and this is my dear friend and co-author, Adrian Gustin.
Well, thanks, Jess. Yeah, our guest today taught mediation and conflict resolution at Harvard Law School. So there's probably no better person to help us understand how to, as she says, unlearn our silence. As always, we hope the time you spend with us will help reduce the stigma of anxiety at work and in your personal life.
And with us is our new friend, Elaine Ling Herring, who works with organizations and individuals to build skills in communication, collaboration, and conflict management. She is the former advanced training director for the Harvard Meditation Program and lecturer on law at Harvard Law. She is also the author of the just-released book, congratulations, Elaine, Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Live More Fully, from Penguin Books. Elaine, we are delighted to have you on the podcast. Thanks for finding the time.
I'm so delighted to be with you all.
Well, Elaine, we're really interested in your book because, you know, we work with corporations and, as you know, collaboration, innovation, well-being, they all require that people speak up, share their thoughts, but you're saying a lot of people still don't. Why is that?
You know, I gave out and also received the advice around speaking up that is most common, which essentially boils down to just do it. And for those of us who struggle with it, who have life experiences that tell us it's actually not safe to do so, that cognitive dissonance between what my manager is telling me, just tell me what you really think. I'm always here for you. And my brain and my synapses are firing of like, no, that's not true. I tried that at my last job and that's why I'm not there anymore. All of that is happening and we're not talking about it. And so I got really frustrated with that advice, thinking there's more complexity to it. Because even though I taught skills for negotiation, difficult conversations, feedback across industries, across geographies, and I think those tools are sound, some people still don't have the conversations. So I started to wonder why, and I landed on silence. We each have learned some version of silence. We know over time when it's safe to speak up, what's going to get us in trouble, what's not going to get us in trouble. And frankly, in the workplace, we're rewarded for it. Being easy to work with, being a good team player, not rocking the boat means that you holding the party line means you typically get promoted. But it also means that we don't innovate. And at times we can't collaborate because we don't feel seen, known, and heard. And so if we really want to reduce anxiety, work well together, have safe and productive workplaces, we need to collectively solve for silence. And that's not just, hey, you go fix yourself.
You know, it's so interesting that you narrowed in on silence. Because, you know, there's the old joke, right? Better to stay quiet and have people think you're a dummy rather than speak up and prove them right, you know? But those...
And to me, that is all, those are all of the subtle ways that we learn silence over time. As part of writing this book, snitches get snitches was a phrase that I learned too, because the father of a preschooler of my son's classmate said that. And at first I thought it was a Dr. Seuss reference.
Green eggs and ham and snitches get snitches. Yeah.
Right. And that's just part of the ecosystem.
It is. Afraid to speak up, especially young people. You know, they don't know if their opinions will be well received. They worry it'll make things worse, that their careers will get stymied and so on. So how do we overcome that tendency, especially for new employees and the younger generations?
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And that observation, you know, my aspiration in life has to become an 86-year-old grandmother. Because the 86-year-old grandmothers in my life just don't care anymore. There's not that self-consciousness or worry. And it's not just them. It seems like the people in their lives are like, oh yeah, well, you know, she's in her 80s. She gets to do what she wants to do, which begs the beautiful question you're asking of if we are earlier in our careers, what can we do? When it comes to speaking up and using our voices, the first thing to acknowledge is that we're all wired differently. So often in the workplace, there's an expectation that leadership would look like three succinct bullet points with no ums, just the right amount of emotion to show that you care, but not too much that you lose credibility. And those people who can have real-time conversation rather than communicate asynchronously or by typing are celebrated and have leadership potential. And I'd argue that we all are wired differently. So some people communicate more effectively by typing rather than talking. So can we design our communication flows to optimize for voice? So as an individual, to see the way I'm wired as wiring rather than weakness. And for the people who manage those folks to say, yeah, I don't want your ideas if they're, can we reduce the barriers to entry? Is what I'm saying, right? If everyone has to fit into the same box and communicate in the same way and sound the same way, which we can't, then we're only hearing certain voices. So rather than hearing just the loudest voices who fit that mold, can we actually get the best ideas forward? And that usually takes designing the way that we communicate and accepting those differences and different ways of communicating, rather than having communicating in a certain way be a prerequisite. Yes.
Hey, you know, because what I'm guessing is do the hard work up front, everything else gets easier. So if you invest the time up front, is that the message?
It is the message. And notice that you're doing a tremendous amount of work right now, figuring out the workarounds anyways.
Ah, good point.
Right. We're dancing around. We figure out what works by trial and error over time. And in the process, we also undercut trust. And sometimes our relationships don't make it, and there's attrition, and we have a retention issue and we have an engagement issue versus literally a 30-second conversation in one one-on-one that says, hey, what makes it easiest for you to share your thoughts? If nothing comes to mind right now, Slack me later. That 30 seconds to make it discussable also signals that you care, also signals that you're willing to work with them. So too often it feels like this gargantuan task when really you're doing a task right now. It's a question of where do you want to put your energy and what's most efficient.
You know, and I love what you just said, you know, is the idea of finding out really from your people what, you know, what works for them. You know, I love that you said some people type better than they talk, which just defines Chester's and my relationship, I think.
You
know? He talks better than I type.
Did you know that this is an intervention for the
team? Yeah, it really is. Thanks, Elaine. Yeah.
You're welcome.
So, yeah. It's spot on. It really is.
It really is. I type better than I talk. I remember a CEO when Chester and I were working together, and there was some huge interpersonal conflict going on with people in our team, and the CEO called me in and, you know, out of the blue and just says, so what's going on? And I'm going, everything's fine. Oh, it's great. Oh, yeah. And if he'd have sent me an email saying, send me your thoughts, type them out. I would have spent hours and hours on that. And it's so insightful what you're saying. Now, I want to kind of, one thing you've written about is racism and sexism in the workplace and how that, you know, when we confront that, it requires us to unlearn silence, not only ourselves as leaders, but also maybe people whose voices aren't being heard. So help us understand this issue more.
Yeah, and I'm conscious that anytime we talk about racism and sexism, people maybe are tuning out. And let's acknowledge that racism, sexism, any ism disproportionately impacts people who carry those identities. In the book, I talk about them as dominant versus subordinated identities. It's just part of the reality that if you do not carry the dominant identity, whether that is based on race or gender or ability or education, you inherently have an uphill battle. And you inherently are less likely to be believed, more likely to be othered, more likely to be doubted. And it's not because anyone intends to do this. It's just human nature. The way that we combat that, though, is to acknowledge that it's happening rather than to deny or not talk about it at all, to remain silent about it. And so to acknowledge that anytime you carry a subordinated identity, you also don't know how things work around here. Because the dominant norms just seem normal to people. One of my favorite analyses around this is by Deepa Purushottaman, author of The First Few and The Only, who talks, she's maybe 5 feet tall. And anytime she goes into an airplane trying to put the suitcase in the overhead bin, she's like, this was not designed for me. It's that same thing in the workplace, particularly if you have caregiving responsibilities. How are we supposed to work a 9-to-5 with a commute, work as if we don't have kids as if we don't work, making these topics discussable, however uncomfortable it might be, allows us to at least surface the issue, have an honest conversation at looking at in what way silence might be baked into our policies and practices. One of the reasons, and I'm not going to talk about it because I'm so sick of tired of talking about it, as I'm sure you are, is this return to office issue. And yeah. I would posit, as we're not talking about it, right. I would posit that the reason it was such a lightning rod issue is because it implicates a policy that silences some people and supports other people. If it is easy for you to get into the office, if you have built up a skill set for leading in person, you don't necessarily want to build a different skill set for leading remotely or in a hybrid context, but that also silences or diminishes the talent and the potential and the ability of people who benefit from working at home or a flexible arrangement from bringing their best thoughts to work. So the ability to name the issue, not because anyone is to blame, but that we see things more clearly. That's another premise of the book, that for leaders, if you're silencing the people on your team, you are actually living in a skewed sense of reality. It might be a comfortable one, but you don't have the data necessary to make sound decisions. And we end up with situations like Boeing, which we also won't talk about.
Right. And they're not talking about it either. You know, it's so interesting. Adrian and I, in our work, you know, we talk about gratitude in the workplace. We talk about anxiety in the workplace and how you need to build up these skills to create this healthy and happy and engaged place to work where people want to come and perform and be innovative and so on. We always end with, don't leave it at work, take it home. And it seems to me that these skills for you are that you're teaching are ones that could really benefit personal relationships. So why don't you walk us through that a little bit? How do you take that unlearning silence into a personal relationship, into a family setting?
Voice, being deeply known and feeling seen, heard, and known is the core of intimacy. Fundamentally, to be loved and accepted means to be seen for all of the gnarliness and messiness and imperfection that you carry. How can we actually, whether it's a friendship or a marriage or a family, how can you actually be seen, known, and heard if you are silent about who you are, about your needs, and feel like you need to walk on eggshells? And where do you actually get to exhale? Where do you actually get to be yourself? That's not to say that everyone needs to agree with who you are, but can I disclose who I am, how I'm really feeling? Is it okay for me to not be okay? I remember a guy named Kevin in law school who turned to me during our Trust in the States class and said, you know, Elaine, it's okay to be not okay. And I was like, no, that's not true.
You're lying to me.
That's not true for me. Because I feel the need to put on a happy face, to have it all together. And oftentimes that's expected of me as a caregiver, as a spouse, right? Who wouldn't want a quote unquote happy spouse versus the mopey, disheveled version of myself that I actually am? But if there's no place for us to actually be who we are, where do we rest? Where do we exhale? Where do we recharge? So I'd argue that it's even more important at home in our personal lives. We can sort of do the compartmentalization or tell ourselves that we can. It's at work. I'm going to leave it, leave the anxiety, the frustration at work. But if I can't come home and let my hair down literally and figuratively, where do I go?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to make a suggestion for you, Elaine. The way that you expressed being seen, known, and heard, and the way that you said that after you take care of all this stuff that you're doing professionally, you've got a future as a philosopher poet. The way you express that, right, Adrian? You're the writer. When I thought, gosh, I've got to go back and get the print out of that. That was so beautifully expressed.
If there was only a book, Jess, that you might be able to pick up.
What would the title of that book be, Adrian, and where could you find it?
Well, Elaine, tell us a little bit about how people find you and tell us a little bit about where they can find the book, too.
The book is Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Live More Fully, available in hard copy, ebook, audiobook, if you're not sick of my voice, wherever books are sold. And you can find me on LinkedIn most actively at Elaine Lynn Herring.
Excellent.
That's great. Hey, give us some advice. We do a lot of executive coaching. We do a lot of speaking with leadership groups. A lot of managers are struggling with this. How do they really get their people to speak up, to debate, to share ideas? And as you say, they may be stifling speech without even really knowing what they're doing. So give us some advice, a couple of minutes for managers right now. These are some things to go out and start doing.
I love it. Let's go very tactically first, and then I'll engage my philosopher self that Chester is inviting into the world and go theoretical. Very tactically, leaders are usually very well-intentioned and say things like, what do you think? And then there's crickets and silence, and the leaders are frustrated saying, well, I've asked them what they really think, and they haven't told me, therefore, what am I supposed to do? I'd argue that what do you think feels like a trap. If I'm on the receiving end of that question, particularly across power dynamics, I'm thinking, well, how honest do you really want me to be? Do you really want to know? And if no one else is being candid, mimicry is an incredibly powerful force. People who write on influence advise us to do it. There's gravity to conform. So instead of using the open-ended, well-intentioned question, what do you think, I'd invite leaders to use and prescribe leaders to use standard questions, a set of questions that gets at different angles of the same issue. So what are the pros of this idea? What are the cons of this idea? What about this works? What about this doesn't work? What resonates? What concerns do you have? Whatever language and lingo fits in your culture. But what that does is help the people who don't process, again, going back to wiring, who either pre-process or post-process better, I at least know what to expect in that meeting. I know that Adrian is always going to ask ad nauseum, what are the pros and the cons? So I can prepare for that conversation. I'm not caught off guard. There is an expectation that I know what's coming and what's expected of me as a team member. And it is not just to create toxic positivity and tell you what I think you want to hear, but is also to analyze what are the cons. And we start to build that culture that here we talk about both the things that work and don't work because of continuous learning or all the things that might be values to us. So very tactically, change the questions. Now, my philosopher self would say, and Chester, this is for you.
Thank you.
Silence breeds silence. In terms of organizational silence, which researchers have termed the collective phenomenon of saying nothing, if I'm new here, if I'm more junior, what I'm doing to figure out the culture of voice or silence in an organization is I'm watching the people who are more senior to see what they do, to see what behaviors are acceptable. That is how culture is created. So if I look upwards in the organization or look to you, my leader and manager, and I don't see you pushing back, I don't see constructive dialogue, then I'm from a logical perspective, draw the conclusion we don't do that around here. Right. And maybe we have those conversations behind closed doors, but you and I have also coached enough executives to know that sometimes it doesn't even happen behind closed doors. So then how would we have the expectation that it would happen in a different lower part of the org chart? So a lot of the coaching work is, you know, in your C-suite, in those leadership teams, are you creating that culture using those standard questions of analyzing things from different perspectives, having role clarity of who's the decision maker so that when we're consulted, we can advocate for what we believe is right, but know that whoever the decision maker is going to own that and have accountability for the decision. And tell strategic stories so that the people on your team know that whether or not it's public, those conversations do actually happen. We do have constructive dialogue. We do debate things here rigorously. And it's not just accepted, but rewarded, because that's how we get to good decisions over time. And that's how we can bring our best insights to work, not just the ones that are normalized. So as silence breeds silence, voice also inspires voice. If I see Adrian speaking up, I am more likely to also speak up, push back, lend a difference of perspective. And as you're coaching your people, you might also, some people are like, literally, what words might I say to start and inject a different opinion? Two phrases that I really like are, one is, I see it differently. You know, I'm listening to the conversation and I'm like, oh, that doesn't make sense. I don't want to come across as combative. Well, injecting with, I see it differently, at least gets me started to share my perspective. Another phrase is, from where I sit. So from where I sit in sales, that timeline doesn't make sense. Maybe it makes sense from an engineering perspective, but from a client-facing perspective, that's not going to work. From where I sit recognizes that there is legitimacy to my perspective, even if it's limited. My perspective is limited and legitimate, just like yours is as well, but allows me to own the positionality from which I'm speaking.
That's fascinating. I you know, that really rang true to me, that silence breeds silence. You know, and voice inspires voice. Mm-hmm. Well done. Very philosophical, by the way.
I was wondering if I would still make the cut, because my other backup career that is actually in the book is, I've been told that my voice is so calming, I can narrate sleep aids.
Which is also known as an audible book.
Yeah. Told. There you go. Good. Hopefully people aren't falling asleep during the audible book.
Listen, this has been so engaging, Elaine. We're always interested in self-care for really successful people. And so you said everybody's wired a little differently. So what is it that you do to keep yourself in a good space and continue to thrive?
Yeah, it has been such a process, because of course, silence isn't just editing out or self-censoring the words that we say, but silence is also failing to recognize your own needs. And of course, you can't care for yourself if you aren't meeting your basic needs. So for me, really, it has been this journey to listen to, what do I need? Which, as a woman, as an Asian American, as a mother, right? There's sort of a very clear storyline as to why I wrote this book around silence. My needs tend to take last priority. And so a question of, how do I notice, what do I need, and allow myself to meet those needs, even if it's not what I quote unquote should do, what an author is supposed to do. So on pub day last week, you know, you're supposed to be doing all the radio and unboxing. And, you know, I went into the woods and I looked up at the redwoods and I took deep breaths. And I'm a crier, so I let myself cry because the pressure and the buildup, and that's what I needed. And you know what? The world didn't end because I didn't do what society, social media taught me I should do. And I came out of those woods recharged, more grounded, more able to continue the conversation.
Excellent.
Oh, that's just awesome. What a great place to end our discussion. We could keep talking all day with you, Elaine, but thank you so much for coming on today, sharing a little bit of your insights as you've written this amazing new book, Unlearning Silence, out this week, or was it last week, from Penguin. So congratulations on the book. Congratulations on your work. You're going to help a lot of people with this.
Thanks so much for having me.
No, you bet. Hey, sell a million.
I'll look forward to it. Not for the books, but so that people live more fully, right? And we as leaders lead as we intend, that those good intentions actually translate to positive impact, to unleash talent in our workplaces, and really love people at home.
Well, Chess, it seems like we say this every time, but I'm, you know, still a wonderful interview with Elaine. You know, I love this idea of unlearning our silence, because we hear this so often in teams that we're working with. We, you know, our leaders say, or the leaders we're working with, they say, I want them to speak up. And sometimes we don't realize the things we're doing that are quashing people being open with us.
Yeah. And she said, you know, the old philosophy is, look, just do it. Just speak up. You go, wait a minute. That's about as unsafe as it gets, you know. And when leaders say, hey, my door is always open, you know, go ahead, tell me what you think, you know, tell me what you really think. And all these warning signs go up and say, that doesn't sound safe to me. I'll tell you, one of my big takeaways is when she said that silence breeds silence. You know, when, especially when you're new, you're sitting in a meeting, you are people speaking up or are they not speaking up? Okay, I'm going to do that. You know, whatever they're doing is what I'm going to do. And then she went on to say, and voice inspires voice. How do you give people a voice?
Because, you know, we saw this as we were writing Anxiety at Work. We heard this, especially from younger people who said, are you kidding? You know, why would I speak up? What benefit is there? Because I won't, as she says, I won't be seen as a team player. I'm not holding the party line.
Easy to work with.
Yeah. Oh, he's so easy to work with. He doesn't ever make waves. And so who wants to be the person who sticks their head up above the foxhole? You get shot that way. And so, you know, I loved her analogy, the 86-year-old grandmother, which I think, you know, maybe you and I are getting to that point where we go, look, if somebody fires us, a client fires us, we'll be fine. We'll survive. Yeah. We've got to that point where, yeah, we're happy to share our thoughts, but we got to get to that point where we just share what we're thinking. We're going to be happier. We're going to add more. That's the kind of environment we want.
Yeah. No, listen, my dad in his later years, he said, you know, it's great being old. He says, you can say anything. And you know, when you were younger, it might seem a little brash or even creepy. He goes, when you're old, it's just charming. Oh, that sweet old man. Yeah. I love that. 86-year-old grandmother, they just don't care. They'll just tell you, you know. I really appreciated when she said, when we talked about taking it home. You know, being seen, being heard, being valued. And that's the essence of really a healthy and intimate relationship. And she talked about the fact that, look, I'm a mother, I'm a spouse, I'm an Asian woman in, you know, in a white man's world kind of thing. And how do I act? There are certain expectations. My opinions are going to be lower on the ladder. And the example she gave of the 5-foot woman putting her bag in the overhead, this was not designed for me, you know. Design it so that people have a way to express themselves in a way that's most comfortable for them, whether it's a Slack or it's writing or it's speaking or it's in a group, you know, figure that out. And if you do the heavy lifting up front, it gets easier. She talked about a 30-second conversation. Yeah.
Because, you know, that scenario where our CEO called me in, he thought everybody should, because he was a former lawyer, you know who I'm talking about. Yeah. He thought everybody should be comfortable verbally because that's how he made his living. Well, yeah, no, I wasn't comfortable being, you know, talking with higher ups, people of authority about very, you know, touchy situations. But I remember sending you big, long, you know, typed out ideas and you were very thoughtful with it because you saw that's how I communicated. So it's really powerful that way. And so I loved what she was saying when, you know, what can managers do? She said, look, leaders are well-intentioned. They say, what do you think? And everybody's thinking, I think that's a trap.
You know, that's a trap.
Instead of having some,
you're being kind. You're not. You're,
what do you think,
my
everybody?
Anxiety levels to go through the roof.
Exactly. I think you're brilliant, boss. I think every idea that comes out of your mouth is a gem. Versus, she says, have some standard questions. Look, okay. So, what are the pros of this idea? Okay, what are the cons? You know, what are the issues that we're going to face? Who do we need to get involved? Whatever the standard questions are, she says, have those. That's powerful.
Yeah. And then the response, you know, you and I talk about this idea of I noticed when people are anxious means I care. She said, you know, your response can be, well, look, from where I sit, it's a different perspective. I see it differently is a great way to start the conversation. Not that what you're seeing is wrong. It's just from where I sit, I see things differently. Yeah. And then her personal rituals of what do I need? What do I need right now? Do I need to go for a walk? Do I need some quiet? Do I need to be with people? I thought that was such a great question. I'm going to start using that. What is it that I need right now? in this moment. And it's going to vary from moment to moment, right?
But you know what never varies, Jess, is our need for our producer, Brent Klein. See how smooth that was?
And that is such a smooth transition. You're a master. And it was verbal, which is not you.
We need our producer, Brent Klein, to make things sound better than they usually come out. To Christy Lawrence to help us find amazing guests. And all of you who listened in, we appreciate you. If you like the podcast, please share it. We'd also love you to visit thecultureworks.com. You get some free resources there, including you'll find out about a new keynote we have that's pretty exciting, Leading Through Uncertainty.
Yeah, that's a good one. We're excited to get that out there. And, you know, we speak to audiences literally all over the world, virtually or in person, on topics of culture, teamwork, resilience, mental health. Give us a call. We'd love to speak to you at your event. Again, either live or virtual. And please pick up a copy of Anxiety at Work. It's available everywhere. It's on Audible, it's Kindle, it's hardcover. And we also have a new format for it called Lit Video Books, where they've taken our book and condensed it down to a 29-minute video book. It's really interesting. It's litvideobooks.com. And we have our wonderful new gratitude journal called The Gratitude Habit, available everywhere. Listen, we really appreciate you tuning in. And Adrian, as always, I'll give you the last word.
Well, thanks everybody for joining us. Until next time, we wish you the best of mental health.